Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
Andrea Curry's book, Finding Otipemisiwak, out through Arsenal Pulp. She joins me on the program to discuss it. Andrea, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
So I heard this described not as a memoir, but as a narrative nonfiction. And I'm wondering if you can maybe elaborate on what distinction you make there and what you mean by that.
Okay. I had this conversation with my agent, actually, when we were figuring out how to pitch this book. And it was very important to me not to write a memoir for a couple of reasons. One is, so maybe I'll back up and just say my main purpose in writing this book is to contribute to the conversation about the 60s scoop. So I saw some of the experiences I've had in my life as a 60s scoop survivor as ways to kind of dive into some of the issues that the 60s scoop raises around cultural loss, Indigenous identity, blood memory, things like that. So that's really what I wanted to do. I did not want to specifically tell my own story. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that my experience of reconnecting with my birth family and my culture, my Métis nation, and our life on our homeland has been unusually positive for a 60s scoop survivor. And I think given that there are still relatively few narratives out there, few of these stories out there, Michael, I felt it would be irresponsible to just write my own story. It could be quite misleading, actually, for people who don't know a lot about the 60s scoop and its impact. The truth is that the majority of us do not get the positive reconnection experience that I have had. And that's another reason why I weave my younger brother's story into the book as well, because his experience couldn't be more different from mine.
And it stands in very stark contrast, obviously, existing within the same family.
Yes. I think that hopefully illustrates the differences.
Yeah.
That's
one difference. And then I think like structurally, there's some differences in that, you know, you interweave poems and quotations and these like interludes and musings about the river. And I like that's, I would say, an unconventional narrative or memoir structure as well.
Right. And I think that then brings us to talking about Indigenous storytelling. You know, I think a lot of Indigenous writers, many who have inspired and influenced me, including Alicia Elliott and Leanne Petasamasake Simpson and Joshua Whitehead and Billy Ray Belcourt, and I could go on, are really defying genre, maybe even disrupting it, you know? And that's really important to me. I think that literary categories are also a colonial convention. And, you know, it's telling the story in this way, I sometimes refer to it as an act of sovereignty. In fact, this is how I tell stories. These are the stories that came up. They sometimes come up in poems or prose poems or, you know, essays are another way of telling a story too. And I just wanted to honor that. And I want to be part of disrupting those categories and conventions.
Well, the term Otipemisiwak, as I understand it, basically means people who find their own way.
Yeah, people who own themselves, you know, and will not be defined. And I think it is a characteristic of my people that we are not fond of being governed. You know, that's really the history of my ancestors on the land. And you mentioned the river pieces. And I think the other thing is that part of my reconnecting and healing has been to understand that our identities are not separate from the land. Our identities as Indigenous peoples are both collective and ecocentric. So the land and the rivers are a part of how I understand myself. And when I looked back in my life, even before I knew that I was Métis, it's pretty amazing how important the rivers have been to me all my life. So I wanted to tell part of that story too.
So how did you land on kind of like the telling of this book? Like was that something you sussed out in your first draft? Like, did you start writing bits about the river, or did that kind of come about after you'd already written kind of your story without the river or without the poems? Like, how?
No, I didn't just write my story straight up. I really did think of like moments in my life that might illustrate things, like Blood Memory, for instance. And that, I think it's pretty evident in that particular piece that I go between my own experiences and what I then learned later on about blood memory. I think the rivers are part of my story, and my story are part of, and my family story are part of the rivers. I don't think it's that, I don't separate them in that way. I don't know how else to talk about that.
Sure. I'm always curious in like the structure and like process when it comes to writing.
So I can say that at the very beginning, this wasn't the book I thought I would write. What I really wanted to do was to get some funding and go around and interview and collect stories of 60 scoop survivors and publish a collection that I would edit. And maybe even, I thought, take photos of people on their homeland if possible, or maybe dislocated from their homeland, or, you know, somehow illustrated as well. And I talked to a few people about that idea, just kind of exploring what the funding options would be. And I kind of kept getting it reflected back to me that I should tell my story. And so I thought about that. And then I went through that process I just kind of described, where, okay, I'm not going to just straight up tell my story. I'm not really interested in that. I also think it's really important for this book to not be seen as straight up memoir, because I think that limits its readership. You know, it dictates where bookstores will place it, where libraries will place it. And I think I'm hoping that people might be interested in reading it that might not be as drawn to just read a memoir or one person's story. I hope it has broader reach.
Yeah, no, for sure. Was it the Canada Council Knowing, Creating, and Sharing grant that originally was like the other people's stories? Because I'd never heard that specific kind of project referenced in a book before. No?
No, I actually wasn't. I mean, I think the only way I could have done that collection would have been to go a more academic route in terms of funding. And I didn't really want to do that. I'm sort of not anxious to be... to have this book or this my creation housed in an institution in any way. So I resisted that. But I got the CKS grant to write a first draft, and it just supported me to focus on writing, because I'd left my full-time work as a community-based therapist in a Mi'kmaq community, which I'd done for 15 years. And I was just working part-time, and I needed, you know, to help support myself so I could really focus on the writing. So that grant really enabled me to get a first draft out. And it also gave me this amazing opportunity that, because I had a filmmaker friend who's a really crackerjack grant writer, be a third party reader on my Canada Council grant application, because those are really challenging and detailed applications. And I felt I needed some coaching. And when we were doing up the budget, after we'd done all the text pieces, you know, I was just sort of hoping maybe to get some of the sustenance funding to help support me while I wrote the book. And my friend said, well, you know, you could put money in for a consultant. And I was like, oh, you know, please explain. And as a result of that, I received funding to bring Alicia Elliott to Unamagi, to Cape Breton Island, for a week to hole up in a bed and breakfast near Bedeque in this beautiful place with me, and work with me every day for a week. And it was amazing. We also had some Zoom calls before and after. She did a complete line edit of my manuscript. I mean, I couldn't have had better encouragement. And even just a moment that was very memorable to me was, Alicia was the first person who referred to my writing as a book. She said, well, your book is going to be blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, it's going to be a book, you know? So that mentoring and that, I've been really struck with that, not just Certainly, a lot of Indigenous writers, Katerina Vermette, Amanda Peters, Shailin Jodry, I've had so much help. And it seems to me that in our communities, and even other writers that I know in my neighboring settler communities, have really given me a hand up. And I hope I can do that too. It really struck me that, you know, writers that were really just getting going themselves, not necessarily established for years and years, is that idea that, you know, as soon as you get your footing, you turn around and extend your hand to the next person coming up. And that's something I'm so, so grateful for.
And that maybe spoke to the blood memory you're talking about, you know, on the trap line, that you know, the best place to keep food is in your neighbor's belly.
Yeah, just we take care of each other. And that's, you know, it's these core values of generosity and sharing. And I have so experienced that. I mean, I've experienced it in community now for 20 years working in Mi'kmaq communities. And it's always so profoundly moving for me. I mean, I grew up for the first 17 years in this suburban, you know, world where you don't even necessarily know who your neighbors are, you know, and the insular, which obviously in some of our cases can be quite dangerous, private nature of each individual household. So it's so refreshing and it just feels right to me. It feels like a kind of coming home to relate to people that way, to just want to share, you know. And I hope that that's evident in this book. Like I want my story to be useful, you know. I'm sharing it because I hope it will be helpful. I didn't need to do this for my own healing. I've been working on that for 30 years. I'm okay, you know. I have other ways to look after my own healing. I didn't write the book for that purpose. I wrote it to share something that might be helpful to other people, like food for our bellies, you know, food for our spirits.
I'm curious about kind of like the timing of the genesis of writing this, because in the end you write about making testimony at an MMF panel on 60 Scoop survivors in 2018. Did that predate your working on this book? Like did one spur the other, or is that just a confluence?
No, it's all, I mean, it's just part of the incredible synchronicity that is in my life, that all these things kind of have been this beautiful weaving together from so many different sources and wellsprings of healing opportunities. But the first thing I tried to write when I left my full-time work was a play. And it's still in draft form. I think if and when I return to it, it'll be something quite different than what I originally created. So that was underway already, but it was, again, it was going to be a play about three survivors, 360 Scoop survivors that meet in this cafe called the Moccasin Lost and Found, because lost moccasin is the term that the Métis people use for people like us that were lost to the community. And I wanted, again, to portray three very different, the characters were going to be very different composite characters of all the different 60 Scoop people and experiences I know about. And it just didn't kind of fly. Like it needs work. And I ended up shelving it to do this other project. So that was underway when I first connected with the MMF 60 Scoop department and Albert Beck and his wonderful leadership and all the gatherings I've been able to go to. It's so amazing to have a community. In fact, the first time I ever read any excerpts from this, well, I shouldn't say that. I read a tiny little bit at the Cabot Trail Writers Festival a year ago. But at our gathering in this early March of this year, so really predating the release of the book by months, I was at another gathering of 60 Scoop survivors in Winnipeg, of Métis 60 Scoop survivors, and I was sort of snuck into the agenda to read a couple of pieces. And the response was so wonderful. It was like, these are my people, and they're telling me this is a good thing that I wrote this, and it's going to mean something to them.
Can I ask which pieces?
It's all happened together and supported each other in a kind of beautiful way.
Can I ask which pieces you read at that point?
Yeah, I read Unmasked. So I read First Thing Sunday Morning in a really packed agenda. And I thought, okay, this is not a time to read anything heavy. I just want to read something that, talks about a little bit about the experience of growing up not knowing who we are. So I read that piece about my memory of being asked by my, you know, settler friends in the white suburbs of Winnipeg, what I am ethnically, culturally, and realizing I don't know, and having that moment of feeling like an imposter, feeling like I had to say something. And just never forgetting that moment ever in my life of just not knowing and realizing that everybody else knows, but I don't know. And how that made me feel different and separate and kind of alone. So I read that piece, and then I read the last piece in the book about sort of how Métis people are river people. So a piece that reflected on our relationship with our homeland. Yeah, those are the two I read.
It's interesting you describe that as not like heavy, but in the first of those two, you talk about, you know, the stealth bombs of cultural loss, right? Like, to me, that seems like a very heavy topic.
Actually, that's in the introduction, I think.
Oh, is it?
I didn't read that.
Okay, because the question of who you are comes up when you're talking about that. But maybe I'm conflating the two.
No worries. I think the question of who I am comes up.
Maybe it's recurrent. It's a question that you keep getting asked, or you ask yourself. In terms of the work that you did with Alicia, maybe I can ask about kind of like what does that look like? Like having them read it and make structural suggestions, or are they talking about like the content and what you're revealing of yourself, or how you're revealing of yourself? What goes into
all
that?
All of the above. She gave me revisions every day. She read what I was writing and working on, and, you know, so I was partly revising pieces that I had already written. She had some wonderful suggested edits around word changes, you know. And she also suggested pieces I hadn't written that she thought I should, just from our conversations. You know, we just had these conversations every day, and as a result of that, I wrote the piece on Indigenous pain. As a result of that, I wrote the piece on my work with the residential school survivors. I wasn't sure about writing that. I know they wouldn't mind. You know, they appreciate having that story told. They are a pretty unique group of people that have been helping each other heal for over 20 years, which is not something very many residential school survivors have had the opportunity to do. And so I love to lift up their story and share it, because it's really inspiring. But I wasn't sure about writing it because I didn't want it to seem self-congratulatory. You know, my role has really been to follow their lead since we started gathering, and I hope I expressed that clearly. But yeah, you know, I had questions about, is this my story to tell, you know? And because I really think that there could be a whole book written, you know, they could write their own story with some help. And that might be a really wonderful project to do at some point. But I did talk with some of them about it. And it also is part of my story. It's the most, I'm a very fortunate person. I'm in my, you know, early 60s, and I've been working since I left home at 17. And I don't think, except for maybe 1 6-month contract job that I left early because I didn't really like what I was doing, I'm someone who has loved every job I've ever had. And that's an amazing blessing in life. And I'm very aware of that. But of all the work I've done that I love, the work with the residential school survivors is by far the most has been the biggest honor, the most rewarding, the most inspiring, and just the highlight of my working life, and the highlight of my life in many ways, just in general. So yeah, it is part of my story. And I have shared the book with some of my survivors, and they like it. So I think it's all good.
You write in your introduction about, you know, wanting this to be like a book you would have appreciated when searching for your story. In sharing it with those survivors, like, does it contribute to that for them?
Well, yeah, I think that they're pretty clear that they have also mentored me, you know. And the first time I ever spoke about myself as a survivor, a 60 Scoop survivor, was in the context of a course on Indigenous mental health that I taught at Acadia in the Master's in Counseling program in the 20-teens. And I would always bring in one of my residential school survivors and her daughter to talk about. I did it for 3 summers in a row, so that's why I say always. They that one class would be devoted to that. And the last time, the third year, that survivor, who was a very Margaret Paulette, fondly known as Margaret, who passed away, oh my goodness, I think it's just a year ago, 2 years ago maybe. It's very recent still. But Margaret encouraged me to tell my story as well. So the thing about healing in Indigenous communities that's quite different from kind of in settler communities or in mainstream mental health is it's understood and accepted that the healing is reciprocal. You know, from the mainstream mental health point of view, that would almost be seen as unethical. You know, you shouldn't be benefiting from the work you're doing with people as a therapist. But I mean, that's a bit strong, but there is an ethical kind of piece there that to say that in our work in Indigenous mental health, the healing is reciprocal, we're healing together. Yeah, some people in the mainstream could question that in terms of ethics. But it is absolutely, not only is it acceptable, it's understood to be the way we heal. So yeah, it's been a big part of my healing to be given that opportunity to support these residential school survivors as they heal.
Storytelling is often a part of healing. Do you feel that, like, this is a methodology towards that, either for you or for others?
Absolutely. I believe very strongly that stories are medicine. And I think those stories and that medicine comes through in many, you know, you could say visual art is a way of telling stories, and songwriting is a way of telling stories. And, you know, Louis Riel's famous quote about, you know, when our people awaken, it'll be the artists who lead us. And I think stories, I've received that teaching from many elders. My elder Albert Marshall from Eskasoni First Nation, you know, has said that stories, that relationships are based on the sharing of stories. And certainly in this country, creating new relationships is at the heart of the healing that we all need collectively. So yeah, I definitely see stories as part of that. And in a sense, I feel like working, like shifting some of my time and energy into writing now, because I have a couple other projects I'm working on too, when I can get back to them, is just another way of doing the work of helping people heal that I think Creator has intended for me to do in this lifetime.
So you feel you kind of, this is the journey that you've taken, maybe kind of like the river, that it meanders, but it's always headed somewhere?
Yeah, I feel like I've always said in my life, and that's why it's so funny, like I'm working really just doing therapy part-time now and trying to write part-time. Someone said to me, you know, oh, you're semi-retired. And I thought, no. And I realized I don't really have that, the word retirement, in my vocabulary at all, because I just sort of feel like, I think I'm one of those people that if you love what you do, it's not work. And I don't think I'll ever not do what I do. And I feel like, you know, even before I became a therapist, I was involved in social change work and community organizing and community-based nonprofits. You know, I had the privilege of working in an organization that supported people working in the sex trade on the streets in Halifax. And that was an incredible experience of community and, you know, being, you know, learn. I always say in terms of my therapy work that most of what I learned about how people heal came from the relationships I made with people on the street. Just around respect, how respect is such a powerful healing energy, and that people know what they need, and that when people have the opportunities and the support, that it is our natural inclination to heal. All those things came from other work I did before I became a therapist. And so I feel like the work is always the same, but the job changes, but the work is always the same. So that's the river. I'm still on that same river. And it, you know, maybe the terrain changes, or maybe the current's a little faster, more intense sometimes, maybe more laid back sometimes. But yeah, I think I'm just on the same river.
One of the last sections in the book, you pose a few questions. It's in fact just called A Few Questions. Are those questions you're posing yourself? Are you posing the reader, or is it something you're wrestling with that you're also posing to the reader?
I really wanted to question. I want us to do a deep dive into thinking about the concept of resilience and how I think there can be. I think resilience is a good thing, obviously. We need to survive. We need to have that ability to find ways to get through adverse circumstances. But I think sometimes it almost feels like it's been glorified to me. And I think when we glorify it, we aren't looking at what we really need to look at, which is why it's necessary, and do something about that. You know, rather than hold up, you know, oh, so-and-so is so resilient, or these people are so resilient. Yeah, that's good. We have to survive, and the human, you know, human beings are amazing at finding ways to do that. But let's not be distracted from what's really going on, which is the structures and the systems that perpetuate hurt and harm that have to be changed. So that's where my questions came from in that piece.
And when we're romanticizing resilience, maybe we're kind of demonizing its opposite, or questioning the people who aren't able to be resilient.
Exactly. There's so many, it can be problematic, right? And I think what happens is, you know, this language and these words and these ideas emerge with some meaning, but they can become like they just roll off the tongue, you know? And are we really thinking about what we're talking about here? That was the question I wanted to raise for myself and others. And I also, I don't have the word with me. I have it in my notes somewhere, but I don't think I can find it right this moment. But Melanie Goodchild, who's an Anishinaabe scholar, I think she's at Harvard doing some kind of systems management work or something very kind of above my, you know, almost hard for me to grasp. It's a whole information technologies kind of piece of work. But she was being interviewed by Chokesun Ghost Horse, who has a podcast program. And she was talking about resilience. And she went to two different Anishinaabe elders and asked them if there was a word in Anishinaabe Mo'en for resilience. And separately, they both thought about it. And they both came up with a word, two different words, but they're both words that are used to describe what happens when a river meets an obstacle and how it finds a way around that. And I thought that was really, really cool. And I wish I've got to just commit those words to memory, because I tell this story every now and then and I realize, oh, I need to know what those words are. But
it all comes back to the river. Like it does
in your book.
It all
comes back to the river. Yeah.
Well, Finding Otipi Misiwak, out now. Andrea, thank you very much for taking some time to answer my questions.
I really appreciate the opportunity, Michael. Thank you.